And thank Francois for the opportunity to speak here. This is supposed to be a mini course, you know. I might not get through all the material I wanted to cover, but feel free to interrupt and ask questions. It's a slightly different subject than we've heard up till now because, well, for one thing, all my graphs, there are graphs in the talk. They're all going to be planar graphs, and mostly they're not random graphs, but they are going to have random weights on them at some point. And I have to thank David for introducing the idea that graphs should not be just graphs. You want to soup up the graph structure by adding possibly some weights, either on the vertices or on the edges, and this is what we do in StatMech. So just sort of as a motivating example of what I would like to talk about, sort of the general theme of the talk is that when you're doing statistical mechanics, say in 2D, classically, you know, in the 20th century, people do statistical mechanics on graphs like Z2, right? Homogeneous graphs. But and for example, if we're doing bond percolation, right? There's a famous theorem that what I mean is you take the graph Z2, you erase edges IID with probably 1/2, then the critical probability, I'm sorry, you erase edges with IID probability P, and then if P is less than 1/2, less than or equal to 1/2, then you have a finite components only, almost surely. That's a famous result of Keston. But one could take a slightly, make the problem more interesting by, well, it's already sufficiently interesting there, but you can make a harder problem by having different probabilities on different edges. And for example, if you put probability, so P on all the edges except for this sort of every other horizontal edge, I put a probability Q, which is different from P. But then I want to ask the same question, right? So what I mean is that the horizontal edges, sort of every other horizontal edge, has a probability Q of being erased or kept. I've forgotten whether it's kept or erased. I think it's kept in this case. So the probability Q being open here and probability P of all the edges which don't have labels are kept with probability P. And then you ask about the percolation or not in this setting, everything is still IID. And it's kind of an interesting, well, okay, there is some critical set of probabilities, and there's some relation between P and Q, which provides the sort of critical it's a critical curve now in the space of P's and Q's. If both P and Q are large, then it's going to percolate, and if they're both small, it won't percolate, but there's some critical threshold, and somewhat surprisingly, I guess quite surprisingly, this is in fact a polynomial relation between the two. This is not what I'm going to talk about today. It's just a funny thing. I don't know. I think, you know, very few people know about the existence of such a relation. It's surprising that it's a polynomial. But what I want to focus on today is that there's a way to redraw this graph as a function of the weights P and Q that satisfy this equation. And what you do is as illustrated here, you draw it in such a way that the probability here, the P's and Q's, correspond to edge lengths. There's some function which gives you the edge lengths of the function of the probability, right? And so then a square here, each square becomes a trapezoid, and the angle here is some function of P and Q. And when you draw the graph in this way, you can see that I've sort of shrunk the vertical direction slightly, and stretched this direction a little bit. And nice things happen for the long range properties of this percolation model, right? If you try to do percolation on here on this graph, and you look at criticality, and you look at a large cluster, it'll have some. It won't be isotropic, but it will in this new embedding. So this embedding has various nice features, and I don't want to talk too much about those features, but there, you should just. The take-home message of this slide is that there is a. It is possible in certain cases to draw the graph in a nice way so that it reflects some of the physics of the underlying model.
Quick question: why isn't the polynomial symmetric in P?
Well, because there's three P edges. There's three P's for every Q. Right. I didn't do all. It's not all the horizontal edges. It's just every other horizontal edge. So the P's are on the vertical edges and the other remaining horizontal edges. If you want a symmetric polynomial, you can. While I'm at it, I guess I just discovered this yesterday while I was preparing the slide. Is that if you put the weights, if you put the four weights instead of just two, like let me just call them A, B, C, D for the probabilities in this. Oops, A, B, C, D, and so on in this pattern, then it does become actually a symmetric function of A, B, C, and D, and it's. And the polynomial here, P, is a 1 minus AB plus AC plus CD. It's the symmetric function plus ABC plus ABD plus BCD plus ACD equals 0. So if you specialize that, well, anyway, whatever. That's kind of an acute fact, which I didn't know until yesterday when I just worked it up. Maybe nobody else knows this fact in the whole world except you guys. Anyway, percolation is not the point. So there are many different models and stat-mech models where we have very special kinds of embeddings of the underlying planar graph, which are somehow relevant for understanding the physics of the corresponding model. And this list is just a few that I know of, and there are a few names associated to each, which these references are not meant to be, exhaustive in any sense. It's just a few names that have some relevance. So, for example, if you want to talk about spanning trees or random walks on graphs, then a natural way to draw the graph, if it's a planar graph, is to use a harmonic embedding, an embedding where each vertex is at the its coordinates are the average of its neighbors. When you do that, if you do a random walk on such a graph, the coordinate functions are martingales. And these other authors. There have been several works in the last few years about boundaries of graphs for random walks, like Martin boundary and Poisson boundary, where people use particular embeddings related to circle packings or square tilings of planar graphs. If you have a complicated planar graph, if it doesn't come with any sort of geometric, intrinsic geometry, it's hard to say anything about. What the boundary is, but if you can draw it in a nice way using a circle packing or square tiling or something, then you can. People successfully prove things about these various boundaries for the random walk using these packings, using these particular embeddings of the graph. In the dimer model, this is the one I'll talk about today. There's a special way to draw a graph, actually related to a tiling, called a T graph, related to a bipartite graph. And this was actually useful. This was work I did with Scott Sheffield, to prove some deeper theorems about the dimer model on a periodic planar graph. And, okay, there are a bunch of other examples. Ising models, there's the random cluster model. Special case of the random cluster model is the percolation model. And here, if the underlying graph, if you draw it in a certain way, isoradial means that you've drawn the graph in such a way that every face, the vertices of every face lie in a circle of the same radius 1, kind of like I did in the previous slide, right? If this I drew the this graph has the property that every, you know, just like the square grid, every face is has a circle of the same radius whose vertices lie on it. That's called an isoradial embedding, and those are actually very, very useful. I mean, what I mean is that if you take an isoradial graph and you choose the edge interactions carefully as a function of the geometry of that graph embedding, then something nice happens in the corresponding model. You get a certain integrability structure, which allows you to solve it in certain circumstances. All right. So then, some more recent work is on bipolar orientations and Schneider-Woods, which are related to some other geometric structures on the graph. These are sort of area one rectangulations. I'll talk a little bit about that later. Schneider embeddings are Schneider-Woods are a particular kind of combinatorial structure on a triangulation, and computer scientists, Schneider was interested in drawing the graph in such a way that having a nice straight line embedding of the planar graph where the vertices lie on a grid, so that you can, you know, a priori that the vertices are not too close to each other, which is a kind of hard to do for general planar graphs. To draw them in a so that they're in a compact way, so that the vertices don't get too close to each other, but still have a straight line embedding. But there's recently some StatMech work on these on random objects of this type, which use this this embedding in a nice way. And of course, I should mention the random planar maps are of course a big industry where the goal is to understand something about the metric structure of the graph or the conformal structure of the graph. And here the conformal embedding or the circle packing is of course one very useful way to draw the graph, which reflects somehow the physics in the model. Okay, so all this is kind of background. I want to sort of here's the plan of various subjects that I want to touch on today. I don't know if I'll get too far, but the main subject is these T-graphs and dimers, and in particular, I'll talk about convex embeddings, the space of convex embeddings of a planar graph, and also harmonic embeddings, and eventually discrete analytic functions. And given time, I might say something about the rectangulations. We'll see how it goes. All right. So let's go back to the harmonic functions, or if you like, think about random walks on a graph. Here I have a graph over here on the left, and suppose I have a graph with two vertices v naught and v one, and there's a harmonic function associated to this, which is the probability that if I start at a point, the random walk will hit V1 before V0. Right, that's a classic Dirichlet problem on a graph. So you can think of each edge here as having some weight, which in this case is the conductance of the random walk. So if I'm at a vertex, the probability that I take the probability that I use an edge is proportional to the conductance on that edge. Right? Is this familiar to everybody? Every student of probability knows this model. But these guys, Brooks, Smith, Stone, and Tutt, in 1939, they showed how from a harmonic function on a planar graph, you can make a picture, you can make a tiling of a rectangle. So you have a harmonic function with two boundary values, V0 and V1, which let's assume that the value of the harmonic function here is fixed to be 0, there it's fixed to be 1, and otherwise it's harmonic inside. So then you can make a tiling of a rectangle with rectangles from that data, and it's a sort of a one-to-one correspondence. So the what you do is you put your rectangle in the plane so that the lower boundary is at, so that the lower boundary is at zero, at y coordinate zero, and the upper boundary is at y coordinate one. And then every vertex on the left will correspond to a sort of a horizontal edge in the tiling, which may span several tiles. So it's a maximal horizontal edge in the tiling, and its y-coordinate is the value of the harmonic function. So the harmonic function has values between 0 and 1 because the boundary values are 0 and 1. The harmonic function is the probability that the random walk started at that vertex hits the top before the bottom, hits V1 before V0. And so this correspondence... So to every vertex here, there's a horizontal line there, and I try to indicate it with the colors, right? Every edge on the left is a rectangle in the tiling on the right, and the voltage or the harmonic function is the y coordinate. So these guys were thinking about sort of the electrical interpretation of the harmonic function, where you hook up a battery from the top to the bottom, you know, hook up a 1-volt battery, and then the bottom is at ground, held at voltage 0, the top is held at voltage 1, and the interior voltage is the harmonic function. So that's why I call it voltage. But if you like, you can just say harmonic function is the y-coordinate. And then associated to this harmonic function is a current. It's just the... what's the probabilistic interpretation of the current?
Edge traversal. Edge traversal.
Well, it's the difference of the harmonic function times the conductance is the current. I know the electrical interpretation. It's like the probability that you traverse the edge one way minus the probability that you traverse the edge the other way, something to that effect.
Right. It's the V, the net difference, after some normalization, the net difference between going one way and the other way.
Yes. Anyway, yeah, so if you think about it electrically, it's just the difference in the voltage times the conductance. That corresponds to the width here. So at every vertex, the amount of current so if you think of the current as sort of flowing down the network, the amount of current coming into a vertex is the sum of the widths of the rectangles above it, and the amount of current leaving that vertex is the sum of the widths of the rectangles below it. And because it's a tiling, if you look at this green vertex, right, the sum of the widths of the rectangles sitting on top of it equals the sum below. That means that there's no current lost at that green vertex. The incoming and the outgoing current are equal. So that's one of the reasons this makes a tiling. So the current is the width. The conductance, right? The conductance on the edge, that's the edge weight, is the ratio of the voltage drop or the difference in the harmonic function divided by the. I said it backwards. It's the current divided by the voltage drop, right? That's the aspect ratio of the rectangle. Every edge has an energy associated to it, which is if you made a resistor network out of this thing, it would be the amount of energy dissipated across each edge by this harmonic function, and that's the area of the rectangle here. The width times the height is the current times the difference of the function squared, the Dirichlet energy of the harmonic function. Did that make sense? How many people have seen this before? Very few. But I told you how to get from a network to a tiling. You can also go back the other way. Every tiling gives you a network just by the sort of the obvious thing. You have one edge for each rectangle, and so on. If I'm doing a simple random walk, then all the conductances are 1, then the aspect ratio of every rectangle is going to be 1, so I get actually a square tiling. So when I talk about square tilings here, right, in the first box there, This is the case of simple random walk on a graph. If you want to study simple random walk on a planar graph, it's a useful thing to look at the associated square tiling. And this was actually used by several different groups to say something about the boundary of the graph. Yeah, another thing you can sort of read off, I guess this is not really more information, but once you have the tiling, you can read off the direction of the current flow by just seeing which vertex is the direction of the current flow in the tiling is just vertically downward. Right, you imagine the current just flows vertically. You know, each unit of current sort of flows straight down the tiling here. And so you can sort of you can orient the graph. Any time you have a harmonic function on the graph with two boundary nodes, there's an associated acyclic orientation of the graph. Here. Okay. Let's see. How do I introduce this subject? This talk is going to be a little disjointed, but because there's a lot of things to talk about, there's an interesting landscape of different models to consider that are all somewhat related to each other. One of the goals of that four-author paper, Brooks, Smith, Stone, and Tutt, was to understand square tilings. And there's an old theorem of Dehn about square tilings, which says that, you know, if I have a rectangle which has a square tiling, then the ratio of the side lengths, A over B, the aspect ratio of the rectangle has to be a rational number. The way they, the Brooks, Smith, Stone, and Tutt proved it is as follows. If you have a square tiling of a rectangle, you can make a network from it. The network has one. Just repeating myself, it has one edge for each tile, right? And you know, if you then plug in a battery to the top vertex and the bottom vertex, you know, the current will flow, and there's a unique interior. There's a unique value for the interior potential, the voltage here and here, and that's obtained by solving some linear system of equations. The Kirchhoff rule says there's a unique solution to this linear system, and because all the conductances are one, well here this conductance is two because there's two parallel squares. But they're all rational numbers, and therefore, because it's a linear system there's a unique solution, it has to be rational. The solution has to consist of rational numbers, and therefore the total amount of current is a rational number, and the total voltage drop. Well, if I scale so that this side is one, then this side is going to be, you know, A over B, and that's the total current, which has to be a rational number. So that was a sort of a slick way to prove this theorem of Dehn. Dehn proved it in a completely different way, but it used the uniqueness of the, you know, essentially the underlying Laplacian operator of a connected graph has you know, is invertible if it has a boundary. But okay, so here's an alternate proof. This is like the third proof of Dehn's theorem. Dehn was interested in scissors congruence, so he gave sort of a scissors congruence proof. Then the Brooks, Smith, Stone, Tutt gave a Laplacian random walk proof. Here's a different kind of proof, which is somehow related to a different matrix, not the Laplacian matrix, but the matrix which arises in the dimer model. So here's sort of another proof which, you know, fits on one slide. So suppose I have a purported square tiling here. how do you find the sizes of the various squares? Well, you know, give each square a variable, associate to each square a variable, which is supposed to be the side length, right? And then along every edge in the square, in the interior, there's an equation, right? For example, on this linear equation, along this edge, you know, a plus f, the sum of the lengths of the squares below has to be the sum of the lengths of the squares above. So you get this linear system of equation, one for each internal edge, and well, there's one additional equation which says that, you know, you might as well scale everything so that at least one of the sides is one. Right. So then this, in order to figure out what a through f are, we have to solve this system of linear equations, right, which we can write in matrix form, and there's a matrix here which is a has entries which are 1, 0, and minus 1. Well, the minus 1's come because for every edge, some of the variables are on one side and some of the variables are on another side. And, well, if we knew that the determinant of this matrix was non-zero for some reason, we would know that there's a unique solution to this equation. And because the entries are rational, everything would have to be rational, and then we'd be done. And so the question then, the interesting question is, does this matrix have non-zero determinant? Notice that it's a square matrix. Why? Well, that's already an interesting fact on its own, is why is this matrix square? In this case, it's 6 by 6. But it turns out that there's always one more square than segment on the inside. I'll show you why in a minute. So you can think about that for one slide. But it turns out that the K is the adjacency matrix of a certain graph. So it's a signed adjacency matrix of an underlying planar graph, a certain bipartite graph. And that bipartite graph, its determinant counts something. It counts the number of dimer configurations of that graph. So this matrix is related to a matrix which arises in the dimer model. In fact, it is a Castelli matrix for a certain underlying dimer model here. So, but this the reason I like this proof is because it generalizes very simply, and it generalizes. But it's still going to have the generalization is still going to satisfy this last line here, that the matrix that you get is still going to be a certain adjacency matrix of an underlying bipartite graph. So here's a generalization where instead of having horizontal and vertical edges inside, I let them have arbitrary slopes. So this is called a T-graph. And this is the kind of graph you use when you want to study the dimer model. This is a kind of graph that is very useful when you're studying the dimer model on a general planar bipartite graph. So let me tell you what this is. The definition is here. It's a little bit of a mouthful, but so a T-graph in a polygon. So let's fix the boundary to be, say, a square, a fixed polygon, maybe a convex polygon for now. It's a union of line segments which you draw inside the polygon. They're not supposed to cross each other, but each line segment ends on another line segment, as illustrated. So each one ends, every endpoint of a line segment lies on another line segment, or on the boundary. And there's one proviso, which is that it's possible that you can have points where three or more segments meet. But in that case, they have to meet in such a way that there's one in every half space. So here's sort of what the local picture of a T-graph looks like. The reason it's called a T-graph is that you know, generically every vertex is a T, right? One line segment stops somewhere in the interior of another line segment like that. But I'm allowing a non-generic situation where two or more segments can meet at the same point, but I don't allow segments to meet to sort of in such a way that the that well like this. Two segments are not allowed to meet just by themselves, and if three segments meet, they have to meet in such a way that there's no half space, there's no empty half space, half plane. Right, so they can meet like this, but they can't meet like that. And, well, the reason I'm calling this a non-generic situation is because there's a nearby situation which kind of looks like this. So this is the generic situation where every intersection is a T, but if you sort of let that triangle shrink to a point, you can get this kind of situation. Okay, so going back to the definition, that's the definition of a T-graph. I'll show you some pictures in a minute. It's generic if no two endpoints are equal. And notice that the faces are always convex, because that just follows from the definition. And, well, at least for generic T-graphs, you can do a little Euler characteristic calculation to count the number of faces and segments. If it's got n segments, then there's always n plus one faces. And the reason is that the Euler characteristic of the open disk here, if I remove the blue boundary, I've got an open, topologically an open disk, which has Euler characteristic 1, and I've decomposed that into a bunch of open 2 cells and open line segments. And an open 2 cell, an open face, has Euler characteristic 1, an open line segment has Euler characteristic -1. Okay. Everybody's very quiet here. Does anybody have any comments or questions? I need some audience feedback. Any questions about the definition?
Are you going to build a bijection between these T-graphs and the square tile?
Well, underlying, let's see. First of all, I want to understand the space of T-graphs. Let's see, we did that. So here, associated to any T-graph is a certain underlying bipartite graph. And I want to show that I can go backwards as well. Right, so if I have a T-graph, as you see here, although now the boundary is purple, there's a underlying bipartite graph where you put a white vertex in every complementary region and a black vertex for every segment, and also a black vertex for every boundary segment, like that. And then you join them if they're adjacent. So every white face has a certain number of boundary segments. Intersects the segments, right, one for each edge of that polygon. Each white face is a polygon. It has n sides, then it has degree n. Okay, so that's the bipartite graph. And somewhat remarkably, this bipartite graph actually always has dimer covers. A dimer cover is just a perfect matching. Once we remove all the boundary vertices except for one. So imagine that this boundary polygon is sitting on the floor, and we keep the bottom black vertex, but we remove all the other black vertices. Then you can always find a perfect matching, and there's always, you know, typically many perfect matchings of this graph. This is not obvious, but it's just a couple lines, couple line proof, which I wasn't planning on giving here. But if somebody asks me, I can try to explain why. Let's accept it for now. So what I want to study is large T-graphs. And what I want to show is that one of the things I proved with Scott Sheffield is that the construction goes both ways. If I start with a planar bipartite graph and with the appropriate number of boundary vertices, then I can, if it has dimer covers, then I can build a T-graph from it. But I have to tell you where the parameters are. Right, because the T-graph comes with some parameters. And so here's the theorem. suppose this is just a slight restatement of what we proved with Scott in 2003. So if I have a T-graph with n segments, so I have a fixed underlying bipartite graph, for example, you know, this one, and I fix the boundary, the square, then the set of possible ways to draw that is topologically a ball. It's R to the 2n, homeomorphic to R to the 2n, and there's some actually global coordinates on this space which are geometric, defined geometrically as these, they're called, I call them biracial coordinates, they're the xi's, and the coordinates are, if I draw you a t-graph, you can associate to every t, well, at least if it's a generic t-graph, remember every vertex is a t, then you look at the two faces, you know, below left and below right of that t, and those two faces share each face shares two edges with that vertex. Right, so at every t, I'm going to associate one variable, and that variable is the biratio, is the a times c over b times d, where a, b, c, and d are these lengths in the t-graph. In a non-generic situation, you can do something similar. Here, x is going to be a over b times c over d times e over f, and in the it also works at a degenerate vertex of this type. If you think of this vertex as sort of a degeneration of a very small triangle here, then I should have three variables, one for each of these t's, and that becomes one variable in each wedge of this graph, x, y, and z. And x, well, what happens? How do you define x? Well, in a t-graph. In this t-graph, x is the ratio of two edges of the triangle and the two big edges there. As that triangle gets smaller and smaller, you know, the ratio of its edges is just the ratio of the sine of the angles of appropriate angles of that triangle by the law of sines for a triangle. And so as that triangle shrinks, you know, maintaining its angles, in the limit, you just get the ratio of the sines. You replace the ratio of the edge lengths by the ratio of the sines. Okay, so these are sort of well-defined, even in this degenerate situation for a t-graph. Okay, never mind. Okay, so that's the theorem is that you start with your bipartite graph, and I have to draw a picture now because I didn't put the slide in. Where are the variables in the t-graph? Whenever I have a t in my t-graph, the bipartite graph has a white vertex here, and a black vertex there, and a black vertex there. Right, and these are connected in the bipartite graph. And this, so this x variable here belongs in the face of the quadrilateral face of the underlying bipartite graph. So if I have a t-graph, at each vertex I associate one real number, a positive real number, that corresponds in the bipartite graph to putting a real number on every face. So x variables, x's lie on the faces of the bipartite graph. G. Not only that, so my bipartite graph here, well, remember that this x variable is a ratio of four numbers, A, B, C, and D. This length divided by that length times this length divided by that length. It's natural to put those numbers on the edges of the bipartite graph. So this number A is a length of this segment. That segment is it corresponds to this edge of the graph. So why not put that that length on the edge of the graph here? So that edge gets A, this edge gets B, this edge gets C, this edge gets D. So if I like, I can put the, instead of dealing with X's, which are line the faces of the graph, I could put these individual lengths on the edges of the graph, which is, you know, what David Aldous was doing, you know, A, B, C, D. But then I have to remember that the X variable here on the face is this alternating product of the face weights, A, C over B, D. You know, as I go around the face counterclockwise, well, because the graph is bipartite, if I go from a white vertex to a black vertex, I put it in the denominator. I put that weight in the denominator. And if I go from black to white, I put it in the numerator. Okay? If you'd like to think in terms of line bundles, this is like a monodromy of a discrete line bundle on the graph. Right? Each edge weight is like a parallel transport, and you take the... well, I don't know. Yeah, you take the product of the parallel transports in the appropriate direction around the face, you get the monodromy of that line bundle. All right, so then the theorem says, you know, you take your bipartite graph, you take arbitrary positive real weights on the faces, then you can, that corresponds to an embedding, and that's actually a one-to-one, I mean, it's a parameterization of the space of all T graphs. Please, yeah. Yeah, fixed combinatorics means that the underlying bipartite graph is fixed, and also with the boundary, which vertices correspond to which boundary of the polygon is also fixed.
Do you have a predefined topology on this space?
Topology.
Yeah, because you said the space of T graphs where homeomorphic to R square, right? You want to prove that. I'm asking, do you have a predefined topology on this space?
I see what you're saying. Yes. Two T graphs are close if the line segments are close. Yeah, yes. I mean, that's... is that sufficient? I mean, it's a natural topology. If you put a bunch of segments in the plane, you can parameterize them with their endpoints or something, and you just look at the topology on the pairs of endpoints. But yes, you're right. Any other questions about the statement?
Also, I don't understand what is a diamond cover.
Yeah, we don't see any. Yeah, it didn't really appear anywhere so far. I mean, I showed you that it had the diamond cover, but it doesn't really appear, nor does it appear in the proof anywhere. But somehow it's lurking in the background. I'm again, there's no clock in this room, so can you tell me how much time I've used? 15 minutes left. Okay. Well, I was going to tell you, I can't give you the whole proof. In fact, I've given talks where I've tried to give the proof, but it never comes through, you know, clearly. So I thought I would at least, tell you that the proof is not very, very hard. It's just linear algebra in the end. But on the surface it looks nonlinear because, well, so what I have is this matrix. The matrix, the adjacency matrix of this graph with these weights. See, I'm already getting stuck because the weights are on the faces, but you can choose edge weights sort of arbitrarily so that it is possible to choose edge weights arbitrarily so that the alternating product around each face is your desired x's. But when you do that, those edge weights may not be realizable in the sense that they may not correspond to an actual coming from a T length in the T graph. But what you can do is multiply the matrix, that adjacency matrix on the right and on the left, by diagonal matrices. And when you do that, it doesn't change the face weights, because if I multiply by a diagonal matrix on the left, you know, I multiply both C and D by the same constant, and because one C is in the numerator and the denominator, that constant plays no role. It doesn't change the axis. Similarly, at the black vertices, right? These quantities X are obtained from K, but when you multiply K on the left or the right by a diagonal matrix, the X's don't change, although the edge weights do change. This is a gauge transformation, and you need to find this gauge so that certain things happen, like the all ones vector is in the kernel of the matrix on the left and the right, except for certain boundary values. Anyway, so there's some linear algebra to doing this construction. Trust me that it works. Once you've sort of got this theorem in your pocket, there's a lot of interesting things you can do with it. There's some special cases where you restrict a set of weights, and one thing you can do is restrict the set of weights in such a way that the T graph, every vertex sort of degenerates, and you get an actual embedding of a graph, of a real graph. And so let me just define, suppose I have a graph, a planar graph, and I want to embed it I consider the space of embeddings, which are convex in the sense that each face is convex. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my graph. In this case, the graph is the black, it's a triangle with three dangling edges, and I pin the three dangling edges somewhere along the sides of that triangle. And then I consider the space of embeddings of the rest of the graph, the positions of the remaining vertices, so that every face here is convex. And the theorem is that the space of embeddings is also topologically trivial. It's just a ball of some dimension, twice the number of internal vertices. So I made a little... That's the wrong one. Can everybody see that? Oh, yeah. There's six parameters left, and as I move these parameters back and forth, you can see that the embedding is changing. So this is supposed to be some sort of illustration of the fact that the parameter space is just topologically a ball. I can move these sliders anywhere between the left endpoint and the right endpoint, so it's just a 0, 1 to the 6th power, and I get all possible embeddings of this graph with those where the pinned points are not moving. Well, you know, I thought that was somewhat non-trivial consequence. It's not obvious a priori that the space of embeddings of a graph has such a nice simple topology. And turns out that there's an easy proof of that fact. But let me just give you the proof using the T-graph the technology, right? If I'm trying to embed my favorite graph in the plane, I can take each vertex and perturb it slightly into a non-degenerate T-graph. But once I have a T-graph, then I've got these special coordinates, these biratio coordinates, x, y, and z. Remember that x, y, and z had this particular definition, geometric definition in terms of the edge lengths and the ratio of the signs of the angles. And in this particular case, let me back up here. In fact, I can do it with the clicker. Here it was, right? For a general T-graph with one degenerate vertex, the X is, right, there are sort of two edge lengths associated to this edge, A1 over A2. But if this vertex over here is also degenerate, I mean, it's also a vertex like this one, then A1 equals A2, and then these equations simplify, and you see that if A1 equals A2, then I might as well call them A here, C there, and B there, and then the product of these three numbers is 1 in that case. And conversely, if I choose these numbers so that the product is 1 at every vertex, then there is an embedding of the graph, which has those biratios. Let's see. That's again not the whole proof. It's just the idea behind the proof. One thing you can notice in this case is that this quantity x, right, which was c times sine of this angle divided by a times sine of that angle, is just the ratio of the green area to the blue area. Right, so each of these x, y, and z variables is just a ratio of the area of two triangles, and in particular, they're ratios of barycentric coordinates of the center. If I have a convex embedding, then this point here is going to be somewhere inside the convex hull of its neighbors, and so I can also parameterize a convex embedding by barycentric coordinates. And this sort of gives you the transformation between the barycentric coordinates and my variables x, y, and z. But in particular, that allows you to put a natural Lebesgue measure on the space of convex embeddings, right? If I fix my graph and I look at all convex embeddings, right? I have this global coordinates for it, these x, y's, and z's, or if you like these barycentric coordinates. And I can just choose a natural Lebesgue measure on that space by choosing the barycentric coordinates at a uniform point in the triangle. Lebesgue uniform point in the triangle. And so why not? So here's the first time there's some probability in the talk. Take a large graph. This was just a large honeycomb graph. And I pinned the boundary to the boundary vertices to a square so they're sort of uniformly uniform locations along the square, and then at every vertex I chose IID transition probabilities p q and r where r is 1 minus p minus q, and then I looked at the embedding that arises in that setting, and it's a random convex embedding, Lebesgue random, if you like, convex embedding of the graph. And the question is, what kind of an object is it? It certainly looks, looks interesting. And, is there some scaling limit which gives you a non-trivial homeomorphism of the disk to itself? I don't know. Another special case is a harmonic embedding. So the previous case was I took a t-graph and I set certain products of variables to be 1. And if I take the product of, that is the products around each vertex, if I set the product of the x variables around not just the vertices but also the faces to be 1, right, so remember, I've got an x variable, x, y, or z. I mean, I get these x variables associated to each wedge in the graph. And if I set the products around the vertices to be 1 and the products around the faces to be 1, then I get what's called a harmonic embedding. It's an embedding which corresponds to a spring network where you put on each edge a spring constant, or just a conductance, if you like, and then each vertex is going to sit at a uniform random. I'm sorry. Each vertex is going to sit at the average of its the weighted average of its neighbors, weighted with the weights which are now on the edges. So. This is again a sort of a subvariety of the space of all convex embeddings, but it's a subvariety which is defined by these monomial conditions that the product of the x variables around faces and vertices is 1. So it's a sort of a monomial subvariety, but again a natural one which one should be interested in studying. And just to compare these two cases, right? This is a random convex embedding. This is a random harmonic embedding. the harmonic embedding is much smoother. In the following sense, if you so what you do for the harmonic embedding is you choose random conductances for every edge, if you like, and look at the harmonic function. So every vertex is a weighted average of its neighbors, again with pin boundary. And it's a theorem that this harmonic embedding, the sort of the empirical measure of the vertices, converges to the uniform Lebesgue measure on the square. So what you see there is a very smooth object, whereas this what's going on in this picture, the random convex embedding, is unknown. We don't know what's going on. Here's another picture of a random convex embedding on a square grid this time. And we kind of have competing conjectures here about what happens in the scaling limit as the mesh size goes to zero. Well, it's not really so important for this talk, but there is something interesting to be worked out there. I talked to Ofer about this, and he tried to convince me that this shape actually becomes smooth as in the scaling limit. That is the uniform. The measure will converge to just the uniform Lebesgue measure here, but it certainly doesn't look like it from the picture. But that's an open question. If you let me just say two words. If we go even farther, we started with the space of all T graphs, which is sort of this large space, and then we specialized to convex embeddings of a graph, and then you specialize further to get harmonic embeddings. You can sort of specialize all the way and set all the x's, all these biracial coordinates, equal to 1. And then nice things happen. If you start with the square grid, you know, of course it depends on the boundary conditions, but if you take the correct boundary conditions, then you will actually get a square tiling back again. I don't know why this is fuzzy, but square tilings, as you may know, right, correspond to harmonic functions, but there's a sort of a harmonic function. As I discussed, the y coordinates are harmonic and the x coordinates are also harmonic. These x coordinates and the y coordinates are conjugate harmonic functions, so they correspond to these discrete analytic functions. So in this sort of very special version where all the x's are equal to 1, you don't get any randomness left. Everything is sort of everything is fixed. There are no parameters left, and you get an actual sort of harmonic embedding of the graph with no parameters. And there's some underlying sort of conformal structure which emerges, sort of discrete conformal structure which emerges. Right? In this sort of standard case, right? For every edge, you have a when the conductance is 1, you have the difference in the y coordinates is equal to the difference in the x coordinates. That's some sort of version of the discrete Cauchy-Riemann equation, some discrete version of the Cauchy-Riemann equations. But you can do this with other graphs as well. It doesn't have to be if you start with a different combinatorics, different underlying bipartite graphs, you can get some. Oops, you can get some very interesting also discrete analytic functions, but with different local combinatorics. I think it's a good place to stop. Thank you.
Question.
Yes, also.
Yeah, there are translation invariant T-graphs for the whole space.
Yes.
Like the Gitlock graph. So how does it interact with what you are trying to build or building?
Well, when we worked on T-graphs, we were interested in periodic T-graphs, or if you like, T-graphs on a torus. Mm-hmm. So finite graphs on a torus, because the when you study the dimer model on a periodic graph, on a periodic, you know, planar graph. There's some, and you're interested in sort of studying the integrable properties or limit shapes. All this, right? The underlying T graph is still going to be some periodic or maybe quasi-periodic graph on the plane. But we never dealt with these translation invariant, more complicated translation invariant measures on T graphs. So the theorems I stated were for finite graphs. You know, the topology of T graphs in a finite, with a finite underlying combinatorics.
So, what would be the constructs for? So, if you have a T graph with a translation invariant, what does it say?
Well, I don't know what question you're going to ask about such a thing. We didn't discuss it. We didn't think about it. So probably there's something interesting to be done there, right? The topology of the space. Yeah. Yes.
Can you say what the lack of scaling limit has to do with the CLT?
Let me go back to the picture. If I take my graph and I take the vertex in the center, the combinatorial center of the graph, and then I ask when I give the graph random transition probabilities, there's a certain probability of arriving at the left boundary before the right boundary, right? And that probability is the x location in this embedding, right? So somewhere over here is the combinatorial center of the graph, but its weight is not near the actual geometric center because the weights have skewed it so that it's more likely to hit the left before you hit the right, and so that's the relation, is that the x location of a vertex here tells you the probability for the random walk to hit the right boundary of the graph before the left. Sorry?
Is that related to the corrector?
To the corrector?
Of the random.
Yes. I don't know what the corrector is, but I'm sure. Sounds like the correct thing. Sounds like you have understood the... Yeah?
So you construct your T graphs in the square, right? And do you have similar constructions since they consider a torus?
Yes, there is a similar construction on a torus, which, but then you have two extra parameters, which are the monodromy, horizontal and vertical monodromy. Yes.
Yeah, so you have any two dimension. Right?
Yes.
Here you have four sides.
Yeah, yeah, so, right. I mean, you can construct a T graph on any Euclidean surface, and on any for any polygonal boundary also, in particular on it, but also on a torus.
So like the space you get there, the space you get by construction in torus, it's also as of homeomorphic to
Yes, it's still described by the same coordinates, the x coordinates. You get to decide the x coordinates for free, and then you get a T graph. What's a harmonic embedding? Harmonic embedding is every vertex is at the weighted average of its neighbors, where the weights are the weights on the edges.
Any more questions?